In our last TAG Talks, we provided a refresher on the draft traceability rule in anticipation of the final rule to be published by November 7th. In this session, we take that a step further to discuss what is likely to change or even surprisingly stay the same in the final rule. I am your TAG Talks host, Lisa Lupo, and today I'm talking with TAG's Vice President of Regulatory and Scientific Affairs, Ben Miller, about the soon-to-be-published final traceability rule. Good afternoon, Ben.
Hi, Lisa. How are you?
I'm doing just great. And you?
Doing well.
Good. So I think for our first question, let's just talk about what you see as some things that we might expect to change from the draft to the final rule.
Sure. And we'll dive into a little bit of detail in terms of exemptions before we talk about, you know, kind of some of the other elements of the rule. But the agency was pretty clear in this proposed rule, which came out now a couple of years back in September of 2020, that they were looking for input into should small retailers essentially be fully exempt from the rule. So they had defined small as having fewer than 10 FTEs per location, and basically that would exempt them as a retailer from having to maintain any records related to the food traceable list foods that they may receive and need to keep track of in that regard. So a couple options. One would be to fully exempt them. The second option would be essentially to have them meet the same requirements as larger retailers would have to meet under the rule. So the agency was clear they were looking for some input there. When I look and read the rest of the rule, I don't know that, you know, we're certainly going to see what public comment included and if that had swayed the agency in any particular area. The way they've written this rule, it's sort of like, a Jenga tower, right? If we start to move and take out, you know, kind of key pieces from a traceability standpoint, you know, the whole structure starts to get weaker and eventually falls. So, you know, I think the agency is going to be, it's going to take a strong level of persuasion to change, you know, certain elements of this rule, because again, a lot of it's dependent, you know, one requirement's dependent on another to make sure that full traceability is there within the supply chain.
Okay. So you did also indicate that there were some provisions that might surprise people that are in the draft rule and are likely to make it to the final rule. What would you see as some of those?
Yeah, so I'll preface this too with, I was part of Task Order 6, which way back in 2011, 2012 was what FDA reached out to the Institute of Food Technologists and kind of asked them to put their arms around this problem. Now, if we remember back to kind of the late mid 2000s, we were in the kind of throes of national multi-state outbreaks, which what they seemed to come every 6 months. You know, we had peanut butter, tomatoes, peppers, spinach, you know, fill in the blank. Shell eggs was another one. So this was all kind of coming fast and furious, and really highlighted the need for better record keeping within industry overall. And so back then, FDA tasked IFT to start to characterize this problem. I think one of the things, honestly, that surprised me the most about this rule is the fact that we even have it. We're here now, and that it got to the point of the rulemaking process. I think, in part, because you know there's a fair amount of complexity in just terms of tracking and tracing what's happening in the supply chain. Now, mind you, this is limited to a subset of foods, a subset that was originally referred to as high-risk foods, and now we talk about a food traceable list food. That list is out on the FDA website, current as of 2021. You know, that list can change too over time. So if we epidemiologically start to associate a particular type of food more with foodborne illness or outbreaks, it may go on to that list. Or if we start to see fewer outbreaks associated with a particular type of food, that's going to fall off that list or could fall off that list as well. You know, right now that list tends to be made up a lot of produce that's typically consumed in a raw state or processed produce, as well as seafood. There are some processed ready to eat products on that list as well. So I think one of the other things that's really maybe surprising isn't the right word, but I guess I'm, you know, it's encouraging in some ways, at least an old traceback investigator, to see that this rule does address that, is just how do we track shipments and movements of food through the supply chain using, to some extent, this kind of common identifier. So the rule, if you get into it, talks a lot about traceability lock codes and who can assign a traceability lock code and who can't or who shouldn't be changing that traceability lock code as a product moves through the market or through the supply chain. So one of the areas that was challenging when I did traceback work, and you know, certainly remains so today, is that as products move through distribution and especially through warehouses, less so today, but it's still a common practice to use, you know, invoices, bills of lading, shipping information, kind of in a first out, first in, first out manner to try to figure out what food might have shown up, when did it go out, what lot codes were associated with those shipments. This rule really tightens that up in terms of the requirements and says, you know, if you're receiving product or shipping it, you shouldn't be changing the traceability lot code that's associated with that particular shipment of product. And in fact, if you're breaking down that shipment, you need to keep track of the fact that, you know, you received 1,000 cases from this manufacturer and sent 100 here and 200 there and 300 there, and maintain that traceability lock code through your own distribution activities. So if I'm somebody that's receiving product, I need to keep track of that as I ship it out and move it further down the supply chain. That's certainly something that, you know, FDA investigators and state investigators, as they've tried to do traceback investigations over the years, has really kind of stymied their ability to pinpoint where potentially contaminated food's coming from. So, I mean, I think that's probably one of the more significant changes that the food industry is going to have to consider and contend with, just in terms of documentation and record management. And it's not something that is necessarily in place 100% today within the industry. So I think that that in and of itself is a significant change. Certainly there are some change, you know, other things that just the way the agency approach things. One is sort of differentiating between the different types of critical tracking events. So when food is created or when we start to need to keep track of traceability data, there's sort of three key events. One is origination. So that's usually if you're catching fish or growing produce, you have an origination event. The second is a creation event. And that actually refers to, let's say you have ingredients that they themselves, the individual ingredients, aren't on the food traceability list, but the finished product itself is. So one of the common examples are like nut butters, like peanut butter. Peanuts aren't on the list, but when you take those peanuts, roast them, add salt, add, you know, other ingredients to make a finished product that's peanut butter, if that finished product itself hasn't gone through a kill step, that's considered a creation event and something that somebody has to keep track of. And then finally, there's a transformation event where you're taking food traceable foods. So think about something like romaine and mixing it with iceberg lettuce. That salad processing step is considered a transformation event. So you've got origination, creation, and transformation. It's a little bit different than, you know, some existing technology platforms think about these critical tracking events. And that's going to be something that, you know, working towards an understanding of what is the very granular flow of a process, what's happening at each step in that process, and then figuring out, you know, where are the critical tracking events, what records do I need to be maintaining from my upstream supply partners, and then maintaining and pushing downstream. There's a lot of complexity there, and you know, it's going to, I think, take people, you know, a decent amount of time to figure out all of the intricacies and what that looks like from a record management standpoint, if a lot of what we're seeing in the proposed rule makes it into the final rule.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Ben, for providing our audience with some thoughts and expectations on this final rule. Are there any just real kind of key points that you would want people to remember as this starts to get ready to come out?
Yeah, I think, you know, just paying attention, obviously, to what's in the the final rule, and we'll be doing some subsequent webinars and industry outreach in that space. Again, there's a lot of detail in terms of the type of records that need to be tracked and maintained, who does that, you know, for what product, at what point in the supply chain. So there's going to be a lot of kind of homework that needs to be done, I think, you know, for a lot of players in the food manufacturing and food distribution industry to just figure out what do I need to be doing? What are my critical tracking events? And then how am I passing and sharing that information either up or down the supply chain? And what do I have to maintain from as I receive product within the supply chain? So some industries like the produce industry are a little more mature in that way because they've had the produce traceability initiative and things like that have been in place for a while now. Those initiatives and that data collection structure maybe hasn't made it all the way through to distributors and certainly to retailers as they're receiving products. So this rule, you know, over the 2-year implementation period is really going to tie or kind of test the strength of the supply chain and the need to tie a lot of those data elements together. So there's going to be a lot going on, a lot to watch, a lot of detail. And, you know, we invite folks to come reach out to us if they've got questions about what that looks like specific to their operations.
Right. Yep. As you said, I think there'll be a lot going on and we will be sticking with it. So stick with TAG and our TAG talks and our insights, and we will keep you as informed as possible. And feel free, as he said, to call on Ben or Eric Edmonds or any of TAG's experts for any questions or assistance you may need. And as always, be sure to click subscribe to stay up to date on all things food safety and public health from the TAG experts. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, everyone.